you haven't been to Toronto, and then Santa Barbara, and then now this one. And I think that where they run the risk of becoming too cookie cutter is when they start to be too, I want to be the Oscars, I want to influence the Oscars, and then they just become the same movies. It's great when they can, you know, open up and let other films in and really give, you know, challenging films to a bigger audience, to maybe a worldwide audience.
It's interesting. I wonder if there's, I mean, there's a, there does seem to be a bit of a difference. I've noticed in the last few years when I've been to Sundance and South By, you know, there seems to be a shift. Well, Sundance shift has been happening for a while, and South By much more so in recent years. So it's really about a marketing marketing paradigm. Whereas you can attend festivals in Europe like Rotterdam and Edinburgh, which have a marketing aspect to them. But again, it's much more about the idea of the celebration of cinema. That's one of the things I love about this festival. That it's there's more like a celebration of cinema, and much less kind of geared toward some of the kind of laborious industry issues. I mean, we obviously, this is an educational institution, and it hosts the film festival, so there's an educational component, and that stuff is vital for you guys. But it's an exceptional opportunity. I wonder if we're getting lost, though, with, like you said, some of the creating film or even writing about film from a marketing perspective.
It's difficult because I saw yesterday here a movie I know I would never see because either a publicist would send it to me and I wouldn't watch it, or they'd invite me to a screening and I wouldn't go because it had no interest for me. The title I didn't like, the stars weren't particularly appealing, but it was called The Year of Mooring.
Year of Mooring.
Yeah, and that was a really, really good movie. And I was like, wow, this is great. I'm here. I just happened to walk into this theater. I'm seeing this movie. This is really interesting filmmaking. And it's something I never would have seen if I hadn't been here at this festival. I also saw a really great short film with Gerard Depardieu. It was beautiful.
Todd, do you look for specific films for your festival? I've seen you at a lot of festivals. I mean, you're
I've been to South by Southwest. I've been to Fantastic Fest in Austin, and I've been here, and I've been to the Oxford Film Festival a few times, and then the like AFI and LA Film Festival. And in a lot of cases, you end up seeing a lot of films that showed at Toronto or Cannes at some of these other film festivals. And I think there's an opportunity to catch certain films that started out that generated a little bit of buzz here or there. Like Take Shelter is a film that has not come out yet, but like I don't know if it premiered at Sundance this year, but it has sort of generated a lot of attention. And then I saw it at Fantastic Fest, and it was interesting to see how the reaction at Fantastic Fest was much more mixed than some of the early reactions, which were sort of overwhelmingly positive. And I think there's certainly when you attend film festivals, there's an opportunity to see a large volume of films and get a lot of different reactions. But one of the things that I really like is getting a chance to see films at festivals, and on the off chance that you do see something like that film that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily watch ordinarily, but you have a 2-hour window in your schedule or something like that, you decide to catch it, and you totally get knocked out by it. I mean, at South by Southwest this year, I missed a screening and an interview opportunity with this filmmaker, Ben Wheatley, and then the last day that I was there, they held a press screening of this movie, Kill List, which I think is coming out next year. But I saw it, and I was like, this movie better be good, because I got up early to go watch this press screening, and it absolutely, like, it floored me. And it's been one of my favorite movies of the year, you know, and I just think it's like this, like a stunning, stunning movie. And that was, and I had never seen Down Terrace, his first film, which I keep carrying around a screener that I intend to watch. But you know, it's like to get a chance to discover something like that is really rewarding, because you end up championing a film or a filmmaker who you feel like deserves attention. I mean, a few years ago, I didn't see it at a film festival, but Ty West's House of the Devil was a film that totally was like hit the sweet spot of my interest, because I didn't know how badly I wanted a 1983 devil worship movie in 2009, but it was exactly the aesthetic of a movie that I had been sort of desperately wanting, and consequently, like I have covered like The Innkeepers, which is play a lot of festivals this year, and I think it's a really great movie as well. And he's a voice who is a strong alternative to sort of mainstream horror filmmaking.
I saw that at South by, I was blown away. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed that film.
Yeah, but to get a chance to see that, not just early, but to get to see something that, you know, you can raise awareness for, you know, potentially to increase its sort of commercial prospects, but really more than anything to, like, point out that these are filmmakers who deserve to be paid attention to regardless of their commercial potential, I think is really, like, an essential part of your job as a film journalist and a critic, because you, as much as you are required to pay attention to mainstream releases, things that are huge and high profile that certain websites want, you know, to get a chance to also spend some time on something that, you know, was a small release, is really valuable. I mean, I saw Martha Marcy May Marlene, you know, probably 2 months ago or something like that, and it took a while to sort of soak in, and then I ended up writing a piece for movies.com. They do a thing on Monday mornings called, like, sort of Monday Morning Review, which is a much more in-depth and, like, sort of spoiler-filled analysis of a movie, and to get a chance to, like, really deconstruct exactly what you feel like is going on in a film and to talk really in depth. You know, I've seen a lot of people. I was talking to another critic on Friday night who was like, yeah, I really like that movie because I just thought it was, like, it wasn't handled well with this and that. And I was like, I don't think it's about any of those things. And like, I kind of got really excited, and I started, like, talking about all the things that I liked, and they were like, yeah, I should go watch that again, you know? And you know, just, like, literally to have one person go, like, that's a really interesting point of view about a movie that I thought this, and to be interested in going to see it again is, like, very literally makes, like, me feel like my job is totally worthwhile because I have...
Well, and think... Sorry. I was going to say, think all, you all are so much luckier than people who lived in earlier eras, because I was just reading James Wolcott's memoir last night, and he was a Paulette, a acolyte of Pauline Kael, the big critic, and he has two anecdotes about going to screenings with her. And in one, another Pauline acolyte was leaving a screening. They had back-to-back screenings of the same movie, this new director, and she said, "So how was it?" And the guy goes, "I wouldn't bother." And so she thought about not bothering, but it turned out to be Mean Streets, and so she was kind of glad that she did bother. And another that probably would have broken out anyway, but another film called Diner might not have broken out if she hadn't backed it, because they probably would have shelved it. The studio would have shelved it in those days because it was, you know, a bunch of guys sitting around a diner eating fries with gravy and arguing, and it made his career. Well, there's just no chance today that a movie as distinctive as either of those could possibly be overlooked, because there's too many people on the beat. And, I mean, this is just a fraction. There's everybody's on the beat. It's everybody's a critic, and everybody has some kind of access to web presence. So it's harder not to get discovered now by somebody.
Do y'all have relationships with filmmakers, or is that kind of a difficult thing? Because you have to write objectively about the work, and if you know the filmmaker, I mean, you talked about, you know, meeting the filmmaker at a film festival or interviewing them. How does that affect your work?
Sometimes it can trip you out. I know Jeff is, like, really tight with a lot of filmmakers. I kind of had a weird thing happen to me where, like, I was really went to bat for Social Network last year, and
really?
Just kidding. There was a little enthusiasm.
I had just a tiny bit. I had a psychotic break, and everything was fine. No, and so as a result of that, I kind of got, you know, a little bit of a, like, thing with Trent Reznor and David Fincher, so that Trent Reznor will send me an email. You know, he does that. He does his own marketing, so he sends him out. But it trips you out the first time that happens. Because, like, I was like, you're not really Trent Reznor, but it's okay. I'll play along and pretend you are. He's like, no, I'm really Trent Reznor. That's the kind of thing that can mess with your head a little bit. It's like Cameron Crowe's Almost Famous, that movie.
Sure.
It's really like that in a way. Like, they, you know, he's like, just make us look cool to the journalist, you know. And the journalist is like, It's not really my job. But.
And the lesson to be taken away from that movie is to be honest and unmerciful. Exactly. I mean, that's exactly what Lester Banks says in the movie. And, you know, for me, you know, thank God I have not had to review a movie by Ty West that I didn't like. You know, I mean, I loved The Innkeepers and I loved House of the Devil. You know, I mean, thankfully, like, he's a filmmaker who I honestly feel like is... I don't mean this in any sort of judgmental way, but he's like mature enough to understand that if somebody doesn't like his film, it's like just their reaction to it. I mean, there are filmmakers who are certainly going to take it very personally if you don't like their movie. I mean, I reviewed Jennifer's Body, and I had interviewed the filmmaker for that, and before my review came out, and my review was very fair to her. But she was very upset that I did not like the movie and felt like sort of like blindsided, despite the fact that I had spent 3 hours and ended up writing 3,000 words just in interviews on the movie before I even wrote a review. So I mean, the truth is that it's sometimes difficult, but you know, as with I would say the vast majority of things that we do in our business, because of the access that we're granted, it really comes down to like your personal integrity. And if you are able to, you know, emotionally and intellectually separate yourself from what that relationship is, to be able to honestly assess your reaction to something, then it really doesn't matter.
You don't interviewed her for 3 hours. Did you say?
Yeah.
That's it. That indicates a passion and interest on your part that is not doesn't sync up with what you felt about the film, though. So she was naturally expecting.
Well, I mean,
had some strong, you know, positive feelings. 3 hours, that's a big investment.
Well, I mean, we sat down and had lunch, which is actually atypical of the interviews that I do. I mean, I usually do like a 15-minute interview. It was like meet up for lunch. We sat there and ate and talked. So, I mean, it wasn't strictly speaking like this intense 3-hour, you know, thing as much as it was like an unusually long interview, which we were, you know, we just chatted about the movie and about, I guess, other things in her career. So, but I mean, you're right. But it was, it wasn't a situation where I was sitting there going, "This is the other thing I think is great, and the third thing that I think is great is this." And then I went and I was like, "This is not a very good movie." And she, you know, I mean, I just asked, you know, not to give away what my one tiny secret of interviewing is, that like, regardless of what it is, especially if I don't like a movie, my approach is to ask filmmakers questions about how they solve problems that I know they didn't. And when I watch a movie and, you know, I see that somebody wasn't able to nail the tone, it's like, how were you able to maintain this? And, you know, they give you an answer that may or may not satisfy you, but at least you're getting to ask them about those things in a non-confrontational way and getting them to discuss the things that you reacted to.
Jeff, how do you avoid Stockholm syndrome? You and I are walking fossils of the print era who refused to die, and now you're even more eminently on the web. So you're very passionately invested in and sometimes tight with filmmakers, but sometimes less so. I mean, does that weigh on you sometimes if you see something that, you know, if you're in the position of like Pauline Kael, who really loved Bertolucci and then didn't, what do you do?
Well, I think what you have to do, if you can, is convey to them that you're not 100% on the film that they just made.
Give them a
straight, if you can, through email or whatever. But that you like this, which, you know, most gifted filmmakers or competent filmmakers even will usually do some things that you like. If you don't like the overall, you can at least compartmentalize and say 30, 40, 50% of it I thought was quite good, you know, and sometimes that'll placate them if they know that you were half in the bag for the movie.
Half in the bag. Then.
Completely outside of the work that you guys do, like, you'll contact a director to let them know like how you feel about a film before you post something, or
sometimes, or like a email, just privately, just between you and I, just help.
He has that kind of relationship.
Do any of you guys still do junkets? Or?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah?
Many, many of them.
What's that all about? You guys know about what a press junket is? Yes, no?
No.
Yes.
No. I mean, you know, I mean, they're not, I mean, the scene in Notting Hill where he goes through the whole junket process of doing interviews is pretty accurate, actually, in terms of you go in, you check in, they, you know, bring you into a room, you talk to somebody about a movie for 10 or 15 minutes, and then you go and talk to the next person. Some cases you do roundtable interviews, some cases you do one-on-ones. You know, if you have to, you do like a phoner or something like that. You know, it's a little bit of a sausage factory for them in terms of like marketing, but you know, that doesn't mean that, like, you know, my general feeling is that, like, it has less to do with like what the circumstances are than what you do with the information that you get. And you know, if you can come up with even one or two questions in the context of just asking people how they came to a project and all the sort of generic stuff that most people are interested in when they're reading about a movie, then, you know, you can end up with a really interesting piece, regardless.
It's like a combination of speed dating and the way they used to break prisoners in Korean prisoner war camps. They ask them the same question over and over again until they crack. But it's kind of efficient. I mean, from the studio's point of view, you get a whole bunch of people. Instead of arranging laboriously interviews with various people, you've got a whole bunch of them in the same room, and you can just, it's like a, you can get a whole lot of acreage coverage out of a fixed period of time. And there's comic aspects of it, but I don't know, it's sort of efficient. And in a way, I like the way that the stars in particular are people that you wouldn't necessarily, I mean, I wouldn't have gotten Tom Cruise and Steven Spielberg in the same room if it wasn't for the attempt to now I can't remember what the movie was, to get their movie.
Minority Report?
It must have been Minority. Anyway, they would not have been accessible in that way if I hadn't submitted to that. And it was great. And even though they had been practiced in their responses, that then becomes a challenge. You try to get some bit of the information that maybe they didn't have. They're just trying to use you as a conduit to get their idea of the movie into people's heads, but you can ask them whatever, and you
end up you know, trying to like circumvent their rehearsed answers. I mean, John Lasseter by far is the most rehearsed person I've ever interviewed. I mean, like, I kind of admire it if it didn't totally screw up my ability to do my job.
Did he animate you?
Yeah, well, I have tried to talk to. I mean, anytime you try to talk to him about his movies and you. You know, it may be a byproduct of him having been interviewed about Toy Story 5 million times, but when you're trying to interview him, he knows exactly what he's going to say, and it's just like, you can ask that question, he's going to find an avenue to get to the answer that he has rehearsed. But at the same time, I think when you have a situation, like you said, where they're getting asked the same question, if you're able to ask a question that is even marginally different than the stuff that they've been asked, a lot of them really respond strongly to it, because, I mean, like, I was able to interview Ryan Gosling for Drive, which is a movie that I really loved, and by the time I had interviewed him, I had already seen it 3 times. And so I went in there, and I was asking him all these questions about, you know, just his character and the music and how he connected all these different things up. And I got a note from the publicist afterwards saying that he, like, was, like, extremely happy with the interview. I mean, I didn't really think anything of it. I just was like, these are the questions that I thought of. But it certainly felt good to hear that, like, Ryan Gosling thought that I was, like, an awesome interviewer or whatever.
Well, it's like the same situation in Say Anything. I'm not saying anything. In Almost Famous, which is based on Cameron Crowe's actual experience with Neil Young, among others, sort of a combination. But Neil Young accepted an interview and then betrayed him and claimed that he hadn't talked to him, so that he spiked the story in Rolling Stone. But the way the character and Cameron Crowe got in, especially as a teenager, was by proving that he knew something about the art in question and asking highly informed, maybe a little bit pointed even, questions, revealing that he wasn't just a bozo. And you get a lot better material out of them if you. The first impulse is, in Hollywood, is always to just lie and give you something, you know, pabulum and just pre-processed marketing garbage. But then sometimes you can trigger it. That's the challenge and fun of it, is to get past that by showing, wait a minute, I'm actually part of your club, or, I mean, in the sense of part of your club as an appreciator of your talent and your challenges. and how did you do that? And just as the kid gets into the concert by saying, analyzing the band and where it's at, that's what your challenge is as a journalist, especially when you're in a junket situation where they pretty much don't respect you when you go in there.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, I just specifically for all the people in the room that are filmmakers, you know, I wore the shirt today because I'm the greenest person in the room. Like I'm a 23-year-old kid who has the gall to write about films, and I can't bring the depth of life experience or even the depth of movie knowledge that, you know, I have a better grasp of the medium and than I think, you know, the layman would. But what I'm able to bring, I hope, that's different is something that SCAD specifically offered me, which is I have spent time with hands on camera, I've moved things, I've helped at a very ground level build movies, and I have an understanding of workflow and sound and, you know, how all these things work in concert, hopefully from a unique perspective, and, you know, I try and put that out there. And in terms of these interviews, you know, Todd and I had a lunch with Joe Cornish at South by Southwest, who directed a movie you may have heard of called Attack the Block, which is now on DVD, so all the people in this room that have not seen it, I think you will, and you'll probably love it. We were able to have a long chat with him, and, you know, I was able to bring up sound design, like very specific, pointed sound design thoughts about, you know, the creature's roar and how he, you know, moved this stuff. And it turns out that he had dropped money of his own out of his own pocket to do an extra 2 weeks of mixing. And so he could not have been more gratified to have someone pick up on that extra care and work and detail that went into this movie.
And as a further testament to that, I had not seen the movie, so having them have this like massively in-depth discussion, I was completely out of my element until I had seen the movie later on and I was able to interview him and sort of like capitulate. I mean, I told him when we went to the lunch, it was a funny situation because I went in there and I was like, oh, this is going to be a bunch of people, and then it was the three of us, and then he starts asking extremely specific and informed questions about the technical aspects of a movie that I had not even had an opportunity to see yet. So
I've got a kind of trying to change directions a little bit, but it's a question I want to ask you guys. I'm generally just personally curious. It seems like, you know, you mentioned that with a digital SLR and a laptop editing system, anyone can make a movie. And we're seeing that. Doesn't mean everyone should have to watch that movie, but, you know, anyone can make a movie now, and it can look terrific, and we can just look to Vimeo and YouTube and other online resources for consuming that information as testament to that. I'm curious to know how you guys think the cinematic experience is going to change. If we can predict the future, you know, in the next 20 years or so, is it going to, you know, are we looking at what is it? Are we still going to be a few hundred strangers sitting in the dark together, sharing a communal experience, or is it all going to be on demand, home video?
Well, obviously,
if we are in the theaters, are the theaters all going to be these gazillion dollar blockbusters with 3D glasses? Are we going to be there for the amusement park ride? If that's where it's going, what does that mean for the smaller independent film?
It's where it's been going since the early to mid 90s. Theme park movies in the theaters are more and more so, you know, the independent-minded cinemas becoming fewer and fewer. So it's going to be more and more of watching it on your phone and less.
Well, I mean,
and less
if that's the direction it's going, I'm looking around seeing a few dozen directors in this room. What does it mean for these guys?
You know, people there obviously is a community. And everybody talks to each other all the time. It's just that it's through this and not a discussion. Well, these are, you know what I'm saying. It's not a. It's still as impassioned. It's just that the big screen experience that many of us obviously feel very sad about seeing that evaporate. It is evaporating, at least in terms of the really, really good, superb, intimate, personal, passionate films. More and more films, as we all know, the industry is driven by the theme park stuff.
But it's also economics. A couple of friends of mine, I ask them, do you ever go to the movies? And they say, maybe once or twice a year, and we go during Christmas, and we see, you know, the Oscar movies or whatever. Because it's like David Fincher said to me once, you know, it's just always about separating people from that $18, and separating people from that $15. What do you have to do that? Well, we all got called down to see 18 minutes of Jim Cameron's Titanic 3D remake. It's redoing Titanic 3D. And it's like, yeah, that's enough to get people to say, I'm going to drop $20 and see a movie. But a lot of times, you know, artists want to make movies that make people think, and a lot of people don't want to pay for that experience. They're like, no. No, entertain me. So it's like, you do...
We can do both.
You can do both, but if you look at the top grossing films of the year, they're all sequels. It's like people that want, it's like McDonald's and Starbucks, they want to know what they're getting when they drop their money. And so as the... did you have a question?
Oh, yeah, I was going to wait until you finished, but that kind of leads me to a question I've been wanting to ask for the past half hour. What do you feel about, and this goes to everybody here, how do you feel about this whole trend of, like, this regurgitating of old films, you know, whether it comes from, like, 80s nostalgia, like pop culture, whether it's, like, the remake of The A-Team, or in some cases taking a film like Straw Dogs and remaking that. It really feels like Bait Street Cinema, the people behind it, are just out of ideas.
Yeah, it's so I was just going to say, you know, what I found is people, what you can learn from Facebook is that people don't want Facebook versus G+. People don't want more choices, they want less choices. It's easier to make a decision when you've got Big Mac or, you know, cheeseburger. It's easier to make that decision if you know that you know, you saw... But a lot of the people that saw Straw Dogs, for instance, according to Rod Lurie, are people who'd never heard of the original, and that somehow the violence of it, the prestige of it, I don't know, was supposedly designed to bring people into the theater. So that's a little bit of a different case than what's a good example of a remake that, like...
I happen to think Footloose is actually a decent remake that has a continuity with an auteuristic Southern director's sensibility.
Well, see, there's an uptick.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, in terms of remakes, you know, you have to remember that, you know, how many times have Shakespeare's plays been reinvented or restaged? I mean, you know, not just purely like redone in a literal way, but like in different contexts and things like that. Like, I'm not necessarily defending remakes like sort of wholeheartedly, but I do think that there is room with remakes or reboots or whatever these things are as an opportunity for a different filmmaker to offer their point of view on a piece of material that's familiar. I mean, the problem is, like, I agree mostly with you, but I think that there is also a fear among studios of producing anything that doesn't have some degree of familiarity to audiences. So that's why they will update or they will make a movie version of any TV show that they think has any recognition. I mean, that's why there was a Honeymooner movie, you know, like 5 years ago. And that doesn't mean that those properties deserve to be made into a movie or anything like that. You know, but I think the studios, like, are so afraid because of the production costs and everything else that goes into making a movie and marketing it, that they need something that they feel like is a hook before the people even get in the theater. I mean, that's exactly why, like I kind of feel like the industry as a whole refused to take any lessons whatsoever from Inception. I mean, Inception was like a completely original idea. There was no basis in anything else prior to it. It was a huge, huge hit, and they were like, "Well, that's Christopher Nolan," and
outlier,
and you know, and they just but they kind of like threw up their hands with that being a success and being original, and they don't look at that as,
or they've turned it into greenlighting a Twilight Zone movie that they, you know, Warner Brothers is going to put $200 million behind and try and get Christopher Nolan to put his name.
If this is the direction that major distribution is headed in, how do you convince this room full of emerging filmmakers to take a different approach instead of pandering to the lowest common denominator?
Well, because you're it's a path of spiritual death to go along with corporate people and what they want. You're dead if you think like that. If you want to make a film and you know, get their support and their money too. That's pretty much.
But I mean,
I started to go to Columbia Film School, grad film school, and it was 1993, and I was like, I'm going to go to Columbia because Catherine Bigelow went to Columbia, and that's so $100,000 later. the thing was that they filmed in video, and Milos Forman was one of the guys there, and they said, you have to buy a video camera, big clunky Sony video camera, and I was like, I'm paying $20,000 a year to take a film program and use video. Are you kidding me? Nobody uses video. Video is going nowhere. You know, and I said, I want to work on film cameras. So, of course, I dropped out after a semester at Columbia because I wasn't working in film. And now I look around and I go, wow, you know. So that's the reason. It's because the world has opened up to you. You don't have to raise $100,000. You don't have to raise $50,000 to get to buy film, get it developed. You know, it was, you couldn't make a movie back when I, without that kind of thing, without money. And now you can. You can make a movie, a good movie, that you can, you know, that people can sit down and watch in a theater just by using a Canon digital camera. And that, to me, is the most exciting thing. And if I was 20 years younger, I'd be out there making movies. You know why? Because stories need to be told. They need to be told. And it doesn't matter if people come and you become a huge star and you win a lot of Oscars. It doesn't matter. Those stories burst forth from you, and you have to tell them.
There's the couple that made Another World, Another Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw their first film at South By. I forgot, it was the one with the cult leader down in the basement. It was amazing, the resources they used. Somebody's basement, about $100 worth of medical supplies, and a Canon 7D, and it blew my mind.
Yeah. Was, wow. Britt Marling and Zal Batmanglish.
Yes.
I can't remember. It just went out of my head, the name of the movie. But.
Yeah, that's a perfect example, I think, of a woman who's trying to break into acting. No one would cast her. And this guy wanted to direct, and nobody would hire him. So they said, "Let's just write a screenplay for us both of them, and really, really, really just to plug into something we're really both passionately interested in." And the results are explosive.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Go ahead. My question is: we're talking about, you know, avoiding spiritual death, stories bursting forth from us. How do we do these things and eat?
Well, I'll tell you something. I went to UCLA School of Film, Theater, and Television and studied writing. I went to NYU Dramatic Writing Program. I went to Columbia Film School briefly. And I'm blogging about the Oscars, and I'm making a lot of money, and that's how I support me and my daughter. And I don't care. I have no, like, spiritual conflict about that. I love what I do. All the people that I went to school with, all of them, maybe one or two, maybe I could say five, I could count them on one hand, that have taken that dream and actually made it into their working life. But that's no reason to not do it. It's still something you need to do. You only have one life, that's it, and you're going to die a lot sooner than you think. So why not? You know, it's like Steve Jobs said in his speech, you know, you're already basically going to die. You have nothing to lose. So why not? There is no reason why not. How do you eat? Well, you can make money in a lot of different ways. Do you want to make money on movies? Well, that might happen. But it shouldn't be your driving force, because that's a really foolish. It's like playing the lottery. It's like the most foolish way to think about it.
Tar Sim, who just did Immortals, I mean, he made his first film in, like, I think it was 2000 or 2001 with The Cell, and then disappeared until, I think, 2007 or 2008.
And I can tell you why.
Well, the thing is, I like The Cell and I like The Fall, but he was making commercials during that time and making, like, enormous amounts of money, and he basically self-financed The Fall. You know, and that's a lot of filmmakers do that. I mean, you know, it's tragic that Paul Thomas Anderson, it was so difficult for him to get his next movie made after There Will Be Blood, but he's a person who refuses categorically to shoot, to, like, just do commercials to make money. So if he's waiting until he has an idea that I guess somebody will get behind, which he was thankfully lucky to do. I mean, he's one of my favorite filmmakers. And I'm like, dude, just do a commercial so that you can make your next movie, and you
or
know,
get a billionaire,
or something. Yeah, you know. I mean, I mean, you know, when I started doing this, I was working a job as a movie theater manager, and then I got a full time job. And when I lost that job, I was convinced. I was like, you know, I don't know how I'm going to rebuild, like, the contacts that I had or whatever. And that was like the end of 2008. And, like, right now, I basically regularly pitch to about 8 outlets, and literally it's just from working as hard as I could and from continuing to, like, completely almost single-mindedly love what I do, because I really do love this. I mean, like, a lot of people may want to make movies, but I really, like, I have no interest in it. Like, the idea of even looking at a page of a screenplay makes me want to, like, make my brain melt, you know, just like the formatting. But you know, like, I really love this, and that's why I continued to work for you know, very low wages in many cases, just because, like, it's cool for me to get to talk to, he mentioned Brett Marling, like, you know, to see a film and to be that invigorated by having seen something that you that moves you emotionally and artistically, and to get a chance to write about it is 100% worth it, even if you have a month.
I would say, for your point specifically, coming from the perspective of someone who does want to make movies, I would imagine that a lot of filmmakers in this room probably idolize $750 million filmmaker Christopher Nolan, but his first movie following, back in the day when you didn't have your DSLRs and Final Cut, you can't cut everything on your own, he was making a movie across dozens of weekends where he and his actor would get together just on the Saturday and Sunday that they didn't have to go to their day job, and they accumulated and put together a movie. And, you know, it's not an amazing movie, and it didn't, like, light him on fire like a Tarantino or something, you know, right out the gate, but it was his first movie and got that ball rolling to, you know, what it is now. So there's absolutely no reason that, God forbid, you have to work at McDonald's, that you can't accumulate a group of people around you with a like-minded vision, and every spare moment that you have and every extra dollar that you have that's not paying your rent or putting ramen in your mouth, you can spend with a good enough idea that doesn't require, you know, $100 million worth of effects. You can start making movies, and work begets work, art begets art.
Well, and Quentin Tarantino's overnight success was preceded by, I don't know, 10 years of struggle and heartbreak. Working in a video store. And so, yes, the world has transformed since, but it's transformed in some ways that open it up.
Yeah, the tools are there. It's the drive has not been invented.
One thing about now is that, yes, on the one hand, we live in a kind of a media culture. What we do is, you know, we are like the Greek chorus. It's like the movie comes out, they spend years in pre-production, cost all this money, and then we're just like, meh, you know, or thumbs up, thumbs down, and it's instant. But on the other hand, we also have thoughtful people writing about movies. And if you are somebody who is, you know, just coming out of film school and you're making a movie, you can get your movie to a blogger. This is something that it did not used to be this way. You had to break through to the mainstream media. Nowadays, you don't. You can get a blog, any blogger with a big audience, Jeff Weld, anybody, and you can get them to see your movie and write about it. And that's like publicity, and that's what gets you the next project, and that maybe is what gets you some money.
And I think the key too is that Jeff is an excellent example that people are kind of inoculated against marketing, because there's so much marketing that they kind of tune it out, or, you know, you can tell when you're being sold, but, you know, with Jeff you're not being sold, and or any of us, you're getting a personal reaction, and so in a way it sort of thwarts the original machinery, or, you know, I mean, Ain't It Cool used to be a thorn in the side of the industry, and I guess it sort of is still, but it's also, they quickly recognized it's another marketing, it may not be a marketing thing they can quite control, but it's another avenue to the viewers.
Ain't It Cool News was the first site to really penetrate and do script reviews and early reviews, if you will, which were unfair because the films maybe were not entirely finished. But that thorn in the side aspect was alive for, what, maybe 6 months? I mean, they became very
quickly. Well, Harry Knowles was, you know, quoted as one of the top 50 most powerful people in the industry. You know, here's a guy who's never left his couch.
His big career break was being crippled by, what was it, a refrigerator or something?
He
was,
right.
And it didn't look, you just wouldn't have thought that he would be the big power, but he turned into one just because of the democratizing aspect of the internet. But it's not completely democratic, because he had to attract all those eyeballs, sure. And there's a lot of people trying with their sites to attract eyeballs. And
it seems like a lot of people, especially, you know, kids our age, we all see advertising as like this big evil thing. But of course it is. Like, you know, the stuff McDonald's does to put their burgers in front of us is it's horrible. But it seems like what you guys do, I mean, not just for the larger studios, but for, you know, our level of production, the web is like that, you know, form of advertisement. I mean, I've seen Ren do at least, you know, half a dozen stories about things that, you know, our classmates have done since graduation. and like he's waiting on a cut of Titshaw's film so that he can, you know, just like put it in his like little part of the web and like tell people about it. Like, because he wants that content. He wants to see, you know, what us DSLR toting kids are doing.
Yeah.
I just think that, you know, you guys utilizing the advertising students that are like half a block away from you would be a great idea.
It's two classrooms away. Unfortunately, we're this is a great conversation, but our time is running short. Quickly, I want to ask our guest anything that we need to keep our eyes peeled for. Anything that might not be on our radar that you could recommend to us?
Movies,
yeah.
I don't know if any of you've seen Rampart, but I just saw that. That's really good.
Rampart, okay.
Rampart. Oren Moverman's the director.
Oh yeah. Ooh,
Woody Harrelson's the star. And
Messenger played here a couple years ago.
Oh, it did.
Best to Woody Harrelson performance.
It's really good. Weird, ambiguous. Yeah. A lot of trends this year are movies that kind of have ambiguous endings where the protagonist you don't know what happens, it's unresolved, and makes it kind of interesting. You know, I imagine that the younger minds are maybe more open to that.
That's cool. Rampart, all right.
And I've been telling people that they should try and see Tyrannosaur, which is a British film that has a great performance, superb performance by Olivia Colman.
Oh.
The movie's going to strike probably a lot of people as too oppressively downish. There's a genre called British miserable-lism.
Right.
Fair enough. But she is wonderful, and it's really worth seeing for...
It's a Tyrannosaur, okay.
I just got nominated for 7 British Independent Film Awards this morning.
Cool. This morning.
It's that Paddy Constantine film, right?
I kind of like Pina by Wim Wenders. It's a 3D movie about a... the work of the great choreographer, Peter Bausch, and it's in 3D, and it's also available. Some of the people voting on it for Oscars will see it in 3D, but it's also viewable in a conventional way. I think
the Germans are attacking that 3D, man, it awesome.
I think it's as striking as any movie in its use of 3D, partly because it's such an original thing.
I love Herzog's documentary. I thought that was great in 3D.
And I was going to say, The Cave of Forgotten Dreams, maybe the way that theatrical distribution doesn't become a Cave of Forgotten Dreams, like as remote as the Pleistocene, is through the innovative movies like that, because he was having a little trouble getting the kind of leeway he should have, but thanks to 3D he got a big old hit that you wouldn't have expected. I mean, you wouldn't have been able to sell that in a lot of meetings with suits. I want to do a movie about cavemen, unless it involved superhero cavemen.
Dreams of albino alligators.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, maybe there's more hope than we say, and maybe the commercial world isn't completely evil. It's desperate for new ideas that might open new avenues for revenue. So,
you mentioned Attack the Block.
Hmm?
Yeah,
I mean, I'll be that geek and say Attack the Block is one of those. I mean, it's a $10-14 million movie. It's made by Joe Cornish, who's got Edgar Wright in his corner. But it's a beautiful, brilliant, Carpenter-esque, stripped down, concise, propulsive action movie that they just don't make. And it has these creatures in it that are, in a world of CGI, are done with a clever idea.
It's the first monster alien movie that I've seen in a long time that almost makes a point of saying these are completely fake. This is as good as we could.
Right. Do. They're like
and
comic
really
books. Really,
you can see glowing eyes and all. But it completely works because they just acknowledge that, and you're not looking for that CG dazzlement. It's just really great.
And they will age so much better than any $200 million monster.
Awesome.
Like, this is the kind of movie that you'll be able to watch in 20 years as, like, a classic Carpenter-style action movie.
Todd,
you guys all know Transformers 3. No, I mentioned Kill List, Ben Wheatley's film. I think they're doing, like, a VOD window before it comes out theatrically. I think it got picked up for next year. That's an amazing movie. There's a movie coming out on DVD and Blu-ray soon called Love Exposure. Sion Sono is this... amazing filmmaker. He did another film called Cold Fish, which I think came out a little earlier this year, and I saw both of those movies within a couple months. Love Exposure is a 4-hour movie about a kid who takes it's a Japanese film about a kid who takes upskirt photos and falls in love with a girl in a cult, and it sounds like a crazy movie, and it is, but it is totally amazing, and Cold Fish is also like incredible. And I recommend both of those because I think they're just like totally amazing. And Sion Sono is, I think, just poised to become like a huge like international voice in terms of not exactly on the sort of level of like a Lars von Trier, but he has that sort of transgressive and very purposeful sort of filmmaking style, that there are real ideas behind the sort of provocation and sensationalism of some of his ideas. So.
Thanks. I mean, I want to thank you guys so much for kicking off our discussion series this week. We got about a little less than 10 minutes to get to the theaters for the next screening, but man, thank you guys so much. Please give me a...
Quickly, anybody here who tweets? I assume some of you tweet. This is the first time in, what, 10 years that Krispy Kreme hasn't provided donuts, and I would suggest that you tweet them that you don't like that. Let you know. These corporations, they'll respond to public shaming.
I'm missing my hot Krispy Kreme this week.
So,
yeah, this is,
so it's a tradition that they have failed us on. So.
We should all just do it. I was
fine. Yes, thank you so much.
Oh, I forgot about that. Thanks. Hey, good to see you, man. What are you going to do today? Just trying to figure that out. Is it that there's a Neil LeBute film of 8-minute short at 11:30 a.m.?
No kidding.
I didn't know.